I went to some of the festivities.
House Committee on Judiciary has come to order. The date is February 9th, 2009. Ms. Civil, you want to open a hearing on and work session on House Bill 2170, possible reconsideration?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Briefly, we are revisiting House Bill 2170. For a vote for reconsideration to send it to the floor. It does not need to go to Ways and Means. Some additional information that has been requested from me to provide on the record, and I guess a general recap. This is having to do with the Walsh Act and bringing Oregon into partial compliance with the Walsh Act. There is a deadline for implementing the Walsh Act, and I believe it's March or later in the spring of 2009. However, it's my understanding that Oregon is at this time in the process of writing the letter to request an extension. SORNA, which is the acronym for the sex abuse registration through the federal government, is actually requesting, or not necessarily requesting, but asking the states to consider applying for the extension. The extension will be, I believe, for 1 to 2 years, so possibly bringing us to 2011. In applying for that extension, Oregon will not lose any of the JAG funding they currently receive. Yeah. I believe we covered that. It's approximately $100,000, but it will not be suspended. There will be no loss of any funding if, in fact, Oregon does apply for and receive an extension for implementation. And again, just to recap, no state has presented a package to the federal government and had them approve it and find that they are in substantial compliance. So we are on track with the rest of the states and, in fact, actually taking substantial steps through the bills we heard. I believe it was last week, one of them being 2170. And are there any questions from anyone on the committee regarding this of me? Okay.
Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to permit reconsideration of the vote by which the committee reported House Bill 2170 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move reconsideration of the vote by which the committee reported HB 2170 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves the vote by which the committee reported House Bill 2170 to the floor with a due pass recommendation be reconsidered. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? The vote is reconsidered, and the bill is again before the committee.
Mr. Chair, I move HB 2170 be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Wisnant moves that House Bill 2170 be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion? Yes, Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So was there a fiscal report actually sent that said there was no fiscal, or was it under $50,000? I don't seem to have it in my bill file.
We sent that down. They said we don't need that and sent it back.
Representative Shields, I do not have my file for this. I believe we had a minimal fiscal. We can actually, if you can just give me one moment. We'll go through the paperwork. We did, in fact, intend. Okay, there was no expenditure, and then Ways and Means initially.
Zero.
Yeah. Okay. They indicated that they didn't need to see it at that point.
They had originally asked for it, and then they changed their.
Thank you.
Okay. No further discussion. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Excuse.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Rizzi.
Aye.
Chair Rocker.
Aye. The referral Ways and Means has been rescinded.
You need a carrier.
And I'll carry the bill. Yep. Put me down. Thank you. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2337. Give us a rundown on that, please.
House Bill 2237 would increase the penalty for DUI when the offender has the BAC of higher than or 15% or higher, 0.15. I believe it would also impose a mandatory 72-hour jail sentence upon sentencing.
Is
first.
Yeah.
Thank you. Could I have Tim Walker, Chuck Hayes, and Danielle Romaine, please. Hi, and please, you can go in any order you wish, just be sure to identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Danielle Romaine, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. And I'll just keep my comments very brief. We are here in support of House Bill 2237. The distributors were established after Prohibition, and one of the main reasons for their existence is to promote the regulation of alcohol in recognition of the fact that alcohol is a unique product that, if abused or misused by the wrong person, can cause harm in society. So that is why we are here in support of measures like this one, and we'd urge your support.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Chuck Hayes. I'm the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. The GAC on DUII is a group of people that are appointed by the governor and represent various factions concerned about impaired driving. We include not only law enforcement, but we include treatment, prevention. We also include the court system, prosecutor's office, and then just also concerned citizens, and we also include victims of impaired driving crashes and incidents. I'm here today and testifying on this bill that was actually a GAC bill from the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. And what we're trying to do is that we're trying to amend ORS 813-010 and 813-020 to provide an increased penalty for driving under the influence if an offender has a blood alcohol level of a 0.15% or higher at the time of their arrest. The reason that we support this is because, number one, it is a national trend. In fact, many states are looking at this to try to send a clear message that driving under the influence of these very high blood alcohol percentages is something that obviously is a hazard, even more hazardous than driving under the influence as it is now. So what we're looking for is obviously to try to send a clear message to people that this is not going to be tolerated. My background is in law enforcement. I spent 31 years in law enforcement, 29 and a half years with the Oregon State Police, and in my career I can tell you of just many, many incidents of crashes, fatalities, injury accidents, crashes that occur with high levels of blood alcohol percentages. In fact, if you look at statistics within the state of Oregon, if you go back and we actually looked at statistical data from 2006-2007, looking at the drivers that were killed as a result of crashes, well, of those statistical data, 284 deceased drivers tested positive for alcohol. Of those, 174, or 61% of those, had blood alcohol levels of 0.15% or higher. In fact, the average for those drivers that were killed in crashes in Oregon is a 0.16. And so we know that people are driving at these dangerously high levels of blood alcohol. Two tragic incidents that actually occurred recently that you may remember here in the Willamette Valley is we had a lady that was driving the wrong way on Interstate 5 between here and Albany, and she crashed and killed two women. Her blood alcohol level at the time of that crash was a 0.24. And then just recently we had a fatality that killed four people in Eugene, and the offending driver there had a blood alcohol level of a 0.21. So through the years, we have started to see these blood alcohol levels for crashes, especially fatal crashes, on the rise again. When I started my law enforcement career with the state police in 1974, at that time, the average blood alcohol levels for arrest in Oregon was hovering right around a 0.19 to a 0.20, and that was per arrest. And through efforts of enforcement, other prevention, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. We started to lower those blood alcohol levels per arrest down to about a 0.14. Now all of a sudden we're going back the other way. We're starting to see those increase. In fact, right now the average arrest BAC in Oregon is back to a 0.16, same as the what we're seeing for the average BAC for fatality. So what we think that there needs to be some more stringent sanctions when you have a driver that is a 0.15% or higher. We're, two things that we're looking at would be the increase in a fine, also looking at the 72 hours of consecutive imprisonment. We also know that a lot of states are looking at this. In fact, right now there's 41 states in the country that have an enhanced BAC level for DUI, and they're looking anything from a 0.15. Some states have enacted a 0.20. There are 9 states that do not, and Oregon is one of those states that just does not have that law. And as we talk today, there are states that actually are looking at legislation to enhance that. Something else, too, is that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which is an agency that I work closely with now since my retirement from the state police. I work for the International Association of Chiefs of Police and also work closely with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration on impaired driving issues. So all of these states are taking a look at what can we do to try to send a clear message that we need to do something about this as the blood alcohol levels start to increase again. So the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and other agencies have recommended that states enact some sort of additional enhancements for these high blood alcohol levels. So they have also offered the states federal funding, and federal funding comes to the states if they meet certain criteria. And one of those criteria is to have a law that would address the high blood alcohol levels. So if Oregon is not successful in doing this, well, then yes, we can be affected by not receiving some of those federal funds, which I think are always a good thing in today's economy the way it is to have that support. But regardless of the federal funding or not, we just feel like within the Governor's Advisory Committee that this is good public policy. I think we all have to be concerned about driving under the influence, and especially these high blood alcohol levels, and as I said, how they're starting to increase and go the opposite way now. So maybe this would be a start in trying to send that message that this is not going to be tolerated. So we urge your approval of this bill today, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple things. One, do we know anything about, do we have data on the elasticity of offenders and potential offenders based on relative punitive levels, right? So do we know if, you know, blank is a crime with blank penalty, that blank plus one of penalty yields blank minus one in terms of number of offenders, if that made any sense? Do we know, do we have numbers that suggest this will make an impact to reduce the number of severe drunk drivers? That's the first question. Second question related to that, what's the state of the science or our ability for individuals to know their blood alcohol level, like what, you know, in terms of getting breathalyzers in bars and cars, so that somebody says, oh, geez, I'm a 0.07, I'm okay, I'm a 0.09, I'm not, I'm a 0.16, uh-oh, jail time. You know, how do we think that through?
Chair Barker and Representative Smith, the impact and what we're starting to see, it's relatively new. So, no, I can't really tell you. States, the 41 states that have enacted the high blood alcohol percentages and having those as additional sanctions fairly early. But some of the states that actually got on board in the late 90s, and I can, Maine was one of those, so some of the East Coast states, they actually did see a reduction. Now, cannot give you exact numbers, but they have experienced the reduction in crashes involving those high blood alcohol offenders. So it is positive in those states that enacted it in the 90s. As we move to the west here, we're a little bit behind that, so we still haven't been able to collect that data for the western states. So I think you're going to see more in that area. And then the second part of your question about science or technology, No, it is not there yet. Many states, many people are looking at saliva testing, those kind of things. We do know that there are some businesses that are that are promoting being able to test your blood alcohol level with a device at a bar or tavern before you walk out the door, but those have been found to be very inaccurate, and they're not safe. The latest now is that with an iPod, you can actually get a device now to put a breath testing device on your iPod. And very popular, especially with young people, but it's almost like a game for them instead of actually the safety feature.
They see how high a number they can get.
Exactly,
right.
Sir. So the technology is far from being accurate, and until something comes along, we don't have that type of technology.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And going forward, and I say this partly for the record, partly for listeners, the thing that is most helpful to me, and I don't think that's hyperbole, I think the thing that's most helpful for me going forward is the more data we can collect, gather, and share about how much, as we're spending additional public safety resources, how much public safety that's going to offer the world, that is hugely helpful for me because, you know, I don't love drunk drivers, just want to make sure we make good, sensible decisions.
And Chair Barker, Representative Smith, we couldn't agree more because we feel the same way. And so the states, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, they are asking the states to supply that data so that we can see what type of sanctions work best. And when I start talking about sanctions, too, it, you know, are we totally 100% that it has to be additional jail time, something like that? Ignition interlocks are very good sanctions that are working quite well in other states. The 72 hours, the increased jail time, there are 11 states of the 41 that have enacted that, and it seems to be working fine. And other states have looked at things like ignition interlocks. There's also monitoring devices now. It's an ankle device that offenders can wear. And so it's you're able to dial up and actually get a blood alcohol reading off of their skin in with these devices. So those are things that are out there that as we move along and look at different types of technology that may be beneficial for some of these these sanctions.
Thanks very much. Thanks.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on Representative Smith's comments. So as we know, sentencing, criminal punishment, it really has a lot of different purposes. And clearly, Representative Smith is most concerned with deterrence and deterring, basically maximum deterrence for the dollar. But another one of the possible purposes is really to express society's outrage, just the sheer opprobrium, and just truly punitive effect. And I believe that drunk driving at greater than 0.15 is such outrageous conduct that even let's assume no deterrence level, it's entirely appropriate use of society's resources because it cannot be tolerated.
And Chair Barker, Representative Barton, there's a few of us here in this room that back in 1974, we actually had a law that was on the books for about 4 years that you would cite a person for driving under the influence, and if they had a blood alcohol level of 0.15% or higher, you wrote them another citation. And so they were getting two charges, and That was a way for us to help identify the problem hardcore drinking drivers and treat them differently. But through the years, that law went away. And so really, we're kind of looking at that similar thing more than 30 years later because the problem still exists today.
Thank you. Mr. Walker.
Chair Barker, member of the committee, I'm Tim Walker with the Legislative Fiscal Office, and Shannon asked me to come up and answer any questions you might have about the fiscal impact statement.
How much?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields. My guess is it's not substantial. There will be a cost with the mandatory jail time. There will be a cost to the counties, and I believe the last number I saw was about $105 on average per night. So there will be some cost, but it's hard to tell. It depends upon the enforcement and how many people are misbehaving.
Hello. I think we should be able to get relatively easy the number of statistics of people who are at the 0.15 level and multiply that by 3 times 105.
37,000. Pretty good on your paper you got.
Oh, thanks.
3,700.
Almost more than that.
Chair Barker, 26.
37 from his DUI arrest, 0.15 or greater.
126. Members of the committee, I believe the jail time is just one element of the fiscal impact on this. There will be also be additional costs to the courts and to the state police for having to respond. We would anticipate, and I think it's logical, that there might be increased contested case hearings just because as you increase the penalties associated with the crime. That's a tendency we see. But it's hard to tell how many people will contest, and if there's increased contested case hearings, and state police will also have some additional overtime costs associated with having their people in court, and that would be true for cities and counties also. So it's very hard to actually quantify what that number might be.
In 1974 days, when I was working, we found actually a reduction in court time, at least anecdotally, because people would say, their lawyer would come and say, well, plead to drunk driving, not to the 0.15, and then they would just do that, and they would run them right through, so it would be a plea deal rather than actual trial. So I don't know, and it's 126 out of 3,700 were over 0.15 last year, in 2007.
Representative Barker, members of the committee, that's just for OSP. The last numbers I saw for 2007 were roughly 12,000 DUIs that actually went to court.
Okay.
You know, part of those go the way of diversion also.
Yeah. I would expect a huge number of diversion on those for any, virtually all first timers that are involved in an accident.
Yeah.
So. And this does have a subsequent to Ways and Means. Okay, any further questions in this panel? Thank you. Next, Amy Queen, Ron Noble, or is it? It looks like Noble. And who else am I missing here? And Michael Ewy, please. Some of the extra. Yeah. You just pull it up and chair up. It'll be fine. And again, you go in any order. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Amy Queen, and I'm here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Introductions first? Or? Okay. I'm here to let you know that we support Bill 2237. We believe that, as stated by the different people that were just up here, it would help empower the prosecutors to continue with our goal of prosecuting DUIs in this state, and also to ensure public safety, which is one of the big things that we look to do in enforcing these laws. And the 1.5 stiffer penalty that's been described would, I think, allow us to continue to do that. Ms. Dina Ryerson from the DOJ is here if there's any technical questions about the bill itself and how we would accomplish that.
Okay, maybe we'll just go through the panel and then ask questions. So, Trooper, if you'd like to go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Ewy, last name is Iwai. I'm a senior trooper with the Oregon State Police, and I'm currently the Drug Evaluation Classification Program Manager for the entire state. As an agency, we're going to remain neutral on the House bill. However, I do have some statistical data that I can share with Mr. Chair and the committee members. I can tell you that in 2007, 5,907 DUIs had a blood alcohol content of 0.15% or greater. I can also say that 516 of those were involved in a motor vehicle collision. During the same year, the Oregon State Police, an agency by itself, arrested 3,760 DUIs and had 126 had a BAC or blood alcohol content of 0.15% or greater. 45 of those were also involved in motor vehicle crashes. Similarly speaking, for 2008, Oregon police officers arrested 3,620 DUI drivers, and 104 of those had a blood alcohol content of 0.15% or greater. In addition to that, 36 of those were involved in a motor vehicle collision. The statistical data for 2008 is not yet complete. We're still working on citations to enter that into the database. I can tell you that right now there is currently not a quantitative numerical value that will enhance the fines or the length of imprisonment, and that's one of the main reasons, obviously, for this bill. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Ron Noble. I'm the police chief for the city of McMinnville and currently here before you representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. And we are in support of House Bill 2237. You've heard a lot of statistics. I'm sure you may hear some more statistics on persons with a BAC of 0.15% or higher. But I wanted to just make a brief, some brief comments on those types of people and my experience over 21 years in law enforcement of the type of people that do drink and drive. As you've heard, they are more likely to be heavy drinkers. They're not social drinkers, and they're absolutely not responsible drinkers. These people are more likely to be involved in serious accidents. And as we've heard, many of those that are fatalities in those accidents have a 0.1% or higher. But I think we're all aware of those times and those stories we hear where the one person who is not injured or is not a fatality is the person who is above a 0.15%. They're more likely to be repeat offenders. And if you'll indulge me for just a moment, I want to tell you a story of Mr. Daniel Rice, who was arrested in Yamhill County just late last month for his sixth DUI. Mr. Rice was reported to be intoxicated, and it was visibly intoxicated. And when the deputies showed up, it took three deputies to call Mr. Rice, who refused field sobriety tests. And when he made that refusal and then was told he was going to be arrested, squared off and said, "I'm going to fight you." It took three deputies to arrest Mr. Rice, who was 41 years old. And then when they did get him back to the jail, it took six deputies to get him into the jail. Mr. Rice obviously refused the breathalyzer test, but deputies there and their experience estimated his blood alcohol content at three times or more than the legal limit of 0.08%. His first brush with the law was in June 1989 and received a misdemeanor charge of DUI. He was subsequently convicted of DUI in June of 1990, March 1993, and then received a felony DUI conviction in December of 2002 and another one of June 2002. The felony convictions, he was sentenced to prison terms and then received post-prison supervision. The case is still pending. The judge actually upped the bail to $75,000 from $10,000 in Yamhill County and believed that he absolutely was a danger to the public. District Attorney Brad Berry, quoted in the News Register, said that a person who has done this several times in the past and has been convicted poses a higher public safety risk than someone convicted of the typical DUI. What's difficult to comprehend is that with all of the attention given to drinking and driving over the past 21 years, at least my law enforcement career, these people continue to disregard the safety of themselves and their communities and put others at risk. This is no longer an issue of I had a little too much to drink or I just made a mistake. These are blatant acts of defiance. And no one, given their education, socioeconomic status, age, occupation, or any other group, there's no person in this state that doesn't know that driving intoxicated is illegal, dangerous, and wrong. And I ask that you support House Bill 2237.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Shields.
Thank you. It's Michael.
Mr. Chair. Representative Shields, yes.
Michael. I was just curious. I wanted to make sure I had the numbers right. Your testimony says 5,907 DUII drivers had a BAC of 0.15.
Mr. Chair and Representative Shields, that's correct. That's including all the Oregon police officers, not just state police. So the number is 5,907 with blood alcohol content at 0.15% or greater.
Thank you.
Questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really helpful testimony, and I want to make sure I can parse that I'm parsing this accurately, and it may be in here and I'm just not reading it right. So there were roughly 6,000 DUI drivers with 0.15 or greater. How many were under? If you don't know, that's a fine answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we don't have that exact number right now, but I can get that to you.
No, and that's not that important. And that's not that important a number. But what is helpful to me is to understand the greater incidence of accident or greater incidence of fatality that happens. You know, the difference between 0.08 and 0.149, right, versus point 0.15 and up. You understand what I'm saying? To see those ratios, and if that's in here somewhere, that'd be really helpful. I don't know if we're working this bill today, but that'd be helpful just so I can understand, you know, at what point is the tipping point, and how powerful a difference it is.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, yes, I'll get those statistics as soon as I can.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, panel. Appreciate it. Mr. Paul Cosgrove, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 2237. I'm passing out written testimony that includes some of the data and a few additional data elements about why this is such an important bill, but I'd just like to highlight a couple of them briefly. DISCUS, the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States, is the organization of the distillers and importers into the United States of distilled spirits, and we've been involved in responsibility efforts for many, many years, including we funded the development of the breathalyzer in the 1940s and co-sponsored the Friends Don't Lie, Friends Drive Drunk public service campaign for the U.S. Department of Transportation in the 80s. The one statistic that I think you have not yet heard about hardcore drunk driving is that people with a BAC of 0.15 and above are 385 times more likely to be involved in a crash than those with a BAC less than that. It's a tremendous logarithmic or geometric or some linear kind of increase in the risk when you're talking about blood alcohol levels at that level or above. Appreciate your support of the bill. I hope you pass it out with a due pass recommendation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Cosgrove? Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, actually, this would probably be a better question to ask Chuck Hayes, who was up here first. I don't know if he'd be willing to come back. But
thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Mr. Cosgrove.
We came on together. Years ago, so. Wow, this is a great opportunity.
Yeah. I'm glad you're liking it.
Thank you, Chuck. Mike, originally in your testimony, you mentioned that there were 41 states with enhanced penalties. How long has that been in place of those 41, and can you describe the success rate that they've had?
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, yes, it actually started. The first one that was enacted was 1990, and those were a couple of states on the East Coast that actually enacted that. And again, it goes back to what we saw in the 70s and 80s, where the average blood alcohol levels were coming down per arrest. And as I mentioned, we actually got it down to 0.14 here at one time in the state of Oregon. Well, they started seeing the increase of blood alcohol levels, and then Maine was one of the very first states that took a look at that because they were seeing a large number of crashes that were occurring with high blood alcohol levels. So to answer the second part of that question, are they seeing success rates? Yes, they are, because if you look in some of those states now, the crash rate, fatal crash rate, for an average BACs for those have gone down. They were well over 0.20 in some of those states in the east. And we luckily did never get that high in the state of Oregon, but yet they were seeing it, and they brought theirs down now so that the national level is at 0.16. Oregon is exactly at the 0.16. And there is data out there. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has data exactly what Representative Smith was talking about. I did not bring that with me today, but it's easy to get so that we can show those comparison levels of what is the crash, the percentage of being in a crash, a fatal crash, up to 0.14, and then once it gets 0.15 and above, we have that. So we can provide that. That will be helpful, I think, Representative Olson.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
So it wouldn't be difficult, then, with what you've just described, to kind of develop an outcome should this this bill go in and become implemented as a law?
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, yes, I think that would be easy for us to develop some outcomes, looking at outcome measures, because, yes, our goal is to reduce those crashes that involve those high blood alcohol levels. And I think that we also, as a group, need to be concerned about getting our blood alcohol level going back the other direction instead of the increasing levels that we're seeing. So it's maybe it's time to send a new message that we are concerned about those things. And at the same respect, I think, too, is that it helps us when we start looking at who are these problem hardcore drinkers, that maybe we're a different type of treatment might be necessary, education, those kind of things could follow along right with that.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Hayes, I don't know if you have the number. I've seen a number before that talks about the cost of a fatal accident from a drunk driver, and that doesn't take into account the victim's cost. I mean, the family cost and the emotional cost of that. But is there a dollar figure put on those?
Chair Barber, there is, and I wish I had that with me today. The numbers that we saw were well over $1 million at one point, and now, but those are about 3 years, maybe even 4 years old, and so I'm sure that it's even gone up since those days. So at 1.2, or excuse me, I saw it at 1.2 million at one point, so it's enormous.
Thank you. Any further questions? Anybody? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I just wanted to make a comment, if I could. I came across an article when they were considering a law like this in Michigan in 2006, and just so we know what we're talking about, it says it typically takes a 170-pound man about 7 drinks on an empty stomach in 1 hour to reach a blood alcohol level of 0.15. It takes a 137-pound woman about 5 drinks on an empty stomach in 1 hour to get to 0.15.
Thank you. And with regards to whether they can tell how drunk they are, absolute true rule of thumb is if you ask yourself, am I okay to drive, you're not. I mean, that's driving buzzed is driving drunk. It isn't. It's really dangerous. Yeah, Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I reading this right, that there is a fiscal impact statement coming on this, or the one we have here is saying that there is no fiscal?
Representative Cameron, there should be a fiscal statement in the packet that's in front of you. And it has it's an explanatory fiscal, and that's why I asked Mr. Walker to come and speak to the committee for any questions. He's probably available if there are any further questions.
But Mr. Chair, if I may, this is, again, directed probably at you or counsel. So does that mean that this will, if we pass this bill, if we do have a work session on this bill, that it'll go to Ways and Means?
It will. It does have a subsequent referral.
Thank you. And I have a series of questions for Mr.
Please.
Hayes. Mr. Hayes, thank you for your service to the state police as well as what you do today. Appreciate it. Was there any discussion in the task force because of the potential fiscal of changing the fiscal or changing the mandatory prison or jail time of 3 days and increasing the fine?
Chair Barker and Representative Cameron, yes, that's where the fine increase minimum of $2,500 came in, looking at that. So we did discuss the possibility that there could be a fiscal tied onto that with the 72 hours of consecutive imprisonment. And we also discussed the possibility, should the committee direct us in that area, to look at maybe other sanctions. As I mentioned, there are other sanctions out there, such as the ignition interlock devices, and I understand there are other bills out there talking about that very thing. So we are not dead set today on the 72 hours of imprisonment, should that be a stumbling block, because we would sure like to be not one of those 9 states that does not have this type of a law enacted. We would like to move in a positive direction if we could.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and I think that that's something we need to be really considering as a committee, especially having Representative Shields here, who co-chairs the public safety Ways and Means, that we, if we're really intent on making sure that this gets passed through this building, that it doesn't have something attached to it that's going to get stuck someplace because of the fiscal on it. So
yes.
maybe those kinds of discussions could take place before we take action here.
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, I would agree. And unfortunately, as we know from, I know from my law enforcement days and other folks at this table, is that it seems to be that the number one deterrent is jail. If somebody has to go to jail, that is really, truly the deterrent. And we've done a lot of things and tried a number of different things as a deterrent, and it doesn't always work. But I also understand that in these economic times, too, we have to be looking at other areas. But I know when having closed the jail door on a few DUIs in my career, it has an impact on them immensely.
Further questions? Representative Smith.
Very quickly. Thanks very much. It was really helpful testimony. And the outcome data you were talking about with Representative Olson, anything you got that's hugely helpful? Anything you have on data around other things, you know, things you've tried that haven't worked, that's also hugely helpful. I'm hoping to hold the bills I like to the same standard of you know, data-driven rigor as the bills I don't like. And, you know, modeling here would be helpful.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, we will work on that, and I will also make some contacts with those states that I mentioned and describe to Representative Olson that have been in that done this back in the 90s, and I am sure they probably have some data that they could help us with so that we could take a look at their models.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Hugh Duvall.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Gail Meyer, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are here in opposition to House Bill 2337. I've asked to my right Mr. Hugh Duvall to please come and talk to the committee. He is a very experienced criminal defense practitioner. He has been practicing in Eugene since 1988, and he's been in solo practice since 1991, having been at the public defenders for 3 years prior to that. A substantial portion of his caseload consists of consulting with and counseling individuals who are arrested for DWI offenses, and I've asked him to share his perspective with the committee from the vantage point of someone who counsels people with these offenses. Mr. Duvall.
Chief Barker, members of the committee, thank you. In taking a look at the bill, there's a few things I wanted to mention to the committee that caught my attention. The first is...
Excuse me, can you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Hugh Duvall.
Thank you.
The first is a concern about cost. Of course, for a misdemeanor DUI, the maximum fine is $6,250, unless there's a child in the car, in which case maximum is $10,000. And, of course, a sentencing judge is in a position to take into account the person's economic circumstances and needs the facts of the case and the blood alcohol level and things of that nature. It's my personal perspective that that's a good place to put that discretion. When someone's convicted of a DUI, they're looking at costs and assessments of about $300, an evaluation for the required treatment. In Lane County, that's $150 right now. If they're able to get a hardship license, they're looking at being required to have an interlock device in their car. And even after the suspension period, they're required to have an interlock device in their car after their suspension is up. In Lane County, my office keeps an eye on this so we can tell our clients where to go to try to save some money. It ranges from about $600 per year to about $1,000 per year to have an interlock device in the car, at least the half a dozen or so agencies that we've contacted with regard to that. And then, of course, in many cases, the sentencing judge will require the person to reimburse the state for the cost of either all or a portion of the court-appointed fees if they were given a court-appointed attorney. If they don't, of course, they probably paid a private attorney to assist them. So in addition to that, of course, they're required to go through a program. Now, that's going to range quite a bit because they get evaluated, and the evaluator might decide that there's somebody that needs some education, or they might think that they have a severe alcohol problem and they need intensive rehabilitation. So it's hard to put a number on that, but safe to say we're talking about at least hundreds of dollars there. So we end up in a circumstance where someone is standing before the court being sentenced looking at least a certain number of thousands of dollars of penalty here. And the question becomes, how much greater should that penalty be to get that person's attention? Again, from my experience and my perspective, I appreciate it when I see a sentencing judge ask questions. You know, where are you working? How many children are you supporting? And get into their needs. They can also take into consideration as well how the suspension is going to impact their ability to feed their family and their kids, and whether or not that job is going to continue. We live in a rural state, and many times a DUI conviction, because of the blackout periods that are associated with the implied consent suspensions, might mean the job's going to disappear and the person's going to have to make an adjustment there. So I'm concerned about the cost. I'm also concerned about perhaps a sense of inequity between someone that refuses to blow into the machine and gets a $500 fine because they don't blow, versus somebody who does take the breath test and subjects themselves to a $2,500 fine. Conceivably, it appears you could have somebody who might be a repeat offender who refuses to blow into the machine and is only looking at a $500 fine. It's $500 to $1,000 is the range. Because of all the costs that are associated with a DUI conviction, we see a lot of the lower-end fines, at least in my experience, on those, because it's being added to all these other thousands of dollars. And would someone have the clearness of mind, I guess, in an arrest to decide not to blow because it's going to save them money? In fact, it would, perhaps. And then, while I think that the public is woefully ignorant of minimum penalties and other impacts of driving under the influence, and there's a lot of education that's needed there, would subjecting somebody to a significant fine if the court were aware and law enforcement were aware of the blood alcohol level, will there be any kind of an impact on the increased number of refusals as opposed to people who participate and submit to the breath test? That's something, I guess, I don't know. Perhaps one of the other witnesses might have some statistics from another state. I don't. With regard to the increase in jail time from 48 and then adding 72, back a couple of legislatures ago, I think I don't have the exact date, when a third DUI conviction meant a permanent revocation of your license, from a personal perspective, I just didn't run into many people that were aware of it. I actually wrote an op-ed piece for the Register Guard in Eugene saying, folks, you need to know this because there's no time limit on it. You could have two priors 20 years ago and a third, you know, get a permanent revocation. And so people don't even know that, in my opinion. I don't know how they're going to, I don't know how the deterrent's going to come into effect if they're supposed to be more careful because of the fine and the additional jail time. So that's that from my perspective, and I very much appreciate your time. One last comment. It looks like this might apply to bicycles as well, and if it did, I don't know that that is something that necessarily needs to be involved here, just from coming from a college town at the University of Oregon. Thank you very much.
Okay. Those are expenses that need, that, you know, of course, the judge considers, but do you have any idea how much the funerals cost for that woman and three kids that just got killed in Eugene? I mean, you know, that's the other side of that equation that
sure
we often forget.
I appreciate that comment, and I understand. I appreciate the comment.
Okay, and you've made some very good points. I appreciate those, too. So, Representative Stigler.
Thank you. Mr. Duvall, would it be safe to say that most of your clients know and understand that driving under the influence is against the law, period?
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have some more bills that are coming up that are along these same lines, and among them, bills about refusal. And so at this time, we're not going to work this bill today. Close the public hearing on 2137.
Open the public
hearing on House Bill 2238. Ms. Civil.
House Bill 2238 would increase the penalty for refusing to take a breath test. Excuse me, a breath test, by increasing the period of time under which a person is ineligible to apply for a hardship permit.
Thank you. That's Mr. Hayes, Ms. Queen, and Mr. Noble. Come up, please. Thank you. You can go ahead in any order. Mr. Hayes, if you could tell us if there's any sense, if this passes, that the governor's committee would be doing some publicity so that people know. That was an interesting question brought up about the public not knowing that there's a penalty, therefore losing the deterrent effect of it just being on the books.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, again, my name is Chuck Hayes, the chair of the governor's advisory committee on DUII, and yes, we feel that education is a very strong piece. In fact, a member of our committee is within the education. In fact, we have two that are very much involved in that. So we will be doing and taking a great look at that, the educational piece. The bill that now that you have before you, House Bill 2238, is also a governor's advisory committee bill. And we are looking here under this bill, taking a look at repeat offenders, which we've had some discussion already this afternoon about repeat offenders. But we do know that repeat offenders are a problem, and unfortunately many, in fact you heard Chief Noble talk about one case in Minnville. There's just many of those that are like that. But what we're trying to do here is look at repeat offenders and extend the waiting period for them before they can apply for a hardship permit, or a hardship permit where they can again maybe get their driving privileges back for certain instances that the maybe the courts give them. So it's directed at the repeat offenders. Now they would have to have a one-year waiting period, and it is again just one of those things that we're trying to send a message to those repeat offenders and keep the repeat offenders off of our roads, and also deal with the fact that many of these people that are involved as in repeat offenders, unfortunately, they do tend to refuse the breath test. And so those, again, we're concerned about those type of matters as well. So we feel that maybe extending the wait period would also send a message and try to deter the repeat offenders from committing those crimes. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
So at the present time, if I'm the first time offender, how long, and I refuse, how long do I lose my license for?
If it's a first time offender who takes the test and fails, then they are the first-time offender, fails the test, they got to wait 30 days for a hardship permit. And then if they refuse the test, then it would be a 90-day wait for the hardship permit right now for a first-time offender. This is not the repeat offender.
And so a repeat offender under this bill would then be a year?
3 years.
Would be 3 years.
I'm sorry, 3 years. Okay,
yes,
thank you.
It's currently a year.
Questions, further questions?
Right.
Please, Chief.
Thank you. Chair Barker and members of the committee, thank you again for letting me address you. I'm Ron Noble, Chief of Police in McMinnville, and representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. My earlier testimony under House Bill 2237, I brought up Mr. Daniel Rice, a multiple offender, six-time offender, DUI offender. And as illustrated, Mr. Rice, there was no incentive. In fact, we believe there's a disincentive for Mr. Rice to provide a blood alcohol sample under the current implied consent law, which has left us, unfortunately, with a great line in the newspaper that says that Mr. Rice refused to take the test and the deputies estimated his blood alcohol content to be three times or more the 0.08% level. But that is nowhere close to being able to be admissible in court or use as evidence in any type of trial. Repeat offenders currently, as Mr. Hayes testified, if you fail the test, it's 1 year wait for a hardship permit. If you refuse the test, it's 1 year wait for a hardship permit, and you don't give any evidence towards you.
Oregon Chiefs of Police support
House Bill 2238, and we ask that you do as well.
Thank you. Any questions for the Chief? Representative Krieger.
Just a question. What of your first-time offenders, how many of them ever become a second offender? In other words, are we getting, is it enough deterrent that 80% of the people never do it again? That's the other 20% to continue? We have anything like that tells us that?
Chair Barker and Representative Krieger, some data that I have from 2007, we had 8,193 first-time DUI offenders. We also had 1,889 second-time offenders and third or more offenders, 373. So of the 10,000-plus DUI offenders, we're looking at a little over 2,100 of those that were repeat offenders, if that's helpful.
Please. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Amy Queen, and I am here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and we are in support of House Bill 2238, as indicated by the public safety.
I'd like to ask you if you know, I've heard it stated, I don't know if it's anecdotal, or that frequently a drunk driver will be told by their attorney in the future, don't take a breath test. Is that, I mean, and I'm not, you know, saying that's bad or anything. I mean, you hire a lawyer for a reason. Is that, do you find that to be the case that repeat offenders refuse the test more often on this when they're arrested the second time?
Yes, Mr. Barker, members of the committee, my experience as a prosecutor is usually the repeat offenders I have are refusals, and usually I've heard that excuse at the direction of their attorney. So I have experience with that.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you. Ms. Meyer and Mr. Duvall again, please.
Thank you. Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Gail Meyer, the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I've asked Mr. Hugh Duvall to testify before the committee and his experiences and perspective as an experienced DWI attorney representing clients who are arrested for these offenses. And I give you Mr. Duvall.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Hugh Duvall. As has been mentioned, there are various, I call them blackout periods. My clients, I think, understand the term blackout as they continue to say, but what about this kind of driving? What about that kind of driving? And I say, no, and I found the term blackout kind of gets the message across as opposed to anything perhaps more subtle. Currently, a first time, a person who blows, and within 5 years, there's a five-year limit, we go back to look at enhanced issues. A 90-day suspension, 30-day wait. If they refuse first time, 1 year suspension, 90-day wait. If they've had a prior problem in the last 5 years, that might be a diversion. That might be an implied consent suspension. There's a list of things that can cause an enhancement. If they provide a sample, 0.08 or above, then it's 1 year suspension, 1 year wait. If they refuse, 3 year suspension, 1 year wait. I mentioned we live in a rural state. 1 year is a very long period of time to not be able to legally drive at all, not even get to work. And 1 year is a very long time. 3 years, of course, is a substantially longer. The difference between providing a sample and being suspended for 1 year versus refusing and being suspended for 3 years is already significant. The question that I have is how does this impact the number of people who live in, I live in Lane County, you know, Vinita trying to get to work in Eugene, driving while suspended, just taking their chance? How does it affect the number of people on the roads driving without insurance? As it stands, once the person becomes eligible to drive, they do have to put an interlock device in their car and pay for that and have that maintained. From just my experience, I don't see, and we have some law enforcement here, not only on the committee, but of course witnesses that might be able to add to this, I don't see a lot of this criminal activity of drinking and driving happening during the day. It happens, but we see the majority of it, of course, in the evening and certainly in the early morning hours. And so allowing somebody to pay for the insurance and get the interlock and get all set up and just get back and forth to work
or to their drug or alcohol treatment program, the question becomes, what is the risk there? Does it make, as a public policy question, does it make more sense to let them do those activities? Or, when we weigh it out, is the potential deterrence by not letting them drive at all for 3 years, does it outweigh that? I would like, as a policy matter, to see the squeeze beyond not doing any driving that you don't absolutely have to do to continue to be a productive citizen. I guess if I lived in a state where there's a lot more public transportation, my personal view might change, but I live in Lane County, and if you live outside of our bus system, you're in a difficult spot. One thing I can't tell this committee is what percentage of my clients actually drive. I don't know. They don't tell me. I'm just left to ponder the client who lives in Oak Ridge or wherever around Eugene, or the person that actually lives in Eugene but works a shift where the bus system can't get them there. How many of them are just going to take a chance and drive anyway? I don't know the answer to that. I can't provide it. I just wonder about it. So I, as a matter of policy, I frankly would rather see the length of suspension be extended as opposed to the wait or the blackout period be increased. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, if you're sitting down with a first-time offender, based on this law here, would you, if they get arrested again and they blow, they don't have to wait 3 years to get a temporary license. Isn't that the way I read this law? But if they don't blow, they have to wait 3 years to get a temporary. That's what this changes, correct?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, you said first-time person, a first-time offender?
If you're representing a first-time offender and their case is all done and you're sitting down with them, because we heard testimony earlier about potentially defense attorneys telling people not to blow if you get arrested again. If you're sitting down with that first-time offender after their case, or maybe it's not you but somebody else is trying to figure out how the system works, this law only affects those people who the next time they get arrested refuse to blow. Am I correct as I read this change in the law?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, I think you have that correct. I should point out that I'm not in the room with other attorneys who give clients advice. I spend little to no time. In fact, I'm going to go back to the almost no time strategizing with a client as to what they're going to do or what they should do to avoid conviction if they get in trouble again. Frankly, that is the opposite of the conversation. The conversation is listing off, not only reminding them of the impact they're facing right now, but how much worse it can get, and asking them to pay attention as they go through that that alcohol program, which hopefully is the key to making sure it doesn't happen again. But I can only speak for myself.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and I appreciate that, and I know I'm not pointing any fingers at you at all, but we heard testimony about if somebody was trying to figure out the system. And I just wanted to point out, because you were talking about you don't know about people's transportation and all those other things, but this does not change. For a second-time offender, this does not change or impact them if they blow. This is only for people who refuse to blow on their second time or their second offense, is the way I'm reading this. I just want to make that real clear. So if I blow, I can still get my temporary permit in a year, right?
Yeah, go ahead.
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, that's correct. That's the way I read it.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apologies for the interruption. Representative Cameron.
Representative Cameron, are you through? I'm sorry. I thought you were through.
No, I'm done.
Okay.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out, I read the bill and the law the same way you do. I just want to point out that we are creating, I don't know if you want to call it a loophole, but this bill would encourage somebody to take the breathalyzer test, but only if their previous conviction were within 5 years, because it references ORS 813.430, which actually only applies to DUI convictions in the previous 5 years. That's just how I read it. The council can...
That's correct.
So the subsequent offenders who got it 6 years ago would, again, refuse to blow.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Stiegler.
Mr. Duvall, again, it'd be safe to say that if you had a client who you had seen and counseled on their first DUI, that they would have some expectation of some kind of enhanced penalty the second time around, I'm assuming, after leaving your counsel.
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, I hope so.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be something we talk about after. I'm actually interested in what the defense bar might do with, because we have these sort of interesting conversations, right, where the prosecuting attorneys come in and say, throw them away, and you guys come out and say, don't. And I'm wondering if there's anything we can do beyond that, you know, in addition to that conversation, that reduces the number of drunk drivers and the severity of those drunk driving incidents. And I don't know if that's public education. I don't know if that is in the conversations that you have. I don't know if that's nonprofit stuff, whatever it is. But I'm at least interested in that, because I mean, our job is in part to listen to this and make a judgment on the laws. But ultimately, our job is to reduce the number of people who get killed in auto accidents and who commit drunk driving offenses. So I'm interested in if you have thoughts now or later or whenever.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, I just simply want to let you know that the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association would love to participate in conversations with you or any of you in a think tank process of how to reduce these offenses and recidivism, because no one is well served by them. I would agree.
And I don't want to, some of the questions we asked you, I don't want to work like a personal attack on the defense bar. Defense bar has a very important function in our judicial system. We're here to do the best defense you can for your clients, and I think all of us here understand that. So I hope those weren't taking that as a personal criticism.
Chair Barker, I appreciate that, and I guess I should just comment that not only do I think, but the attorneys that I know closely and do this kind of work view their work as not only assisting their client in a personal circumstance, but helping their client by trying to advise them so it won't happen again.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. No further questions. Thank you very much. And I want to acknowledge that we have written testimony on the record from Vanita Howard, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and Ann Pratt. Yeah. I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2238. I'd entertain a motion to send this. This has a subsequent ways to meet.
Okay. Wait, no. Sorry. It does not.
It does not. Okay. I'd accept a motion to move this to the floor with a due pass.
Mr. Chair, I move then that House Bill 2238 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2238 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I like about this bill and some of the others that have been proposed is that they target the repeat offenders, and I think that's critically important, going after the people who blow high as opposed to, say, bringing down the level from 0.08 to lower levels. We need to hopefully get the attention of people that might be self-correcting, right? Get them in front of a judge, maybe a couple of days of jail time, terrify them so that they never want to come back in the system. But my experience with, you know, the other folks who are repeat offenders is that often they don't think in terms of checking the pluses and the minuses, and okay, how do I fit in the sentencing grid? They tend to just do what they do, and so I think that's our challenge, is to try to engage them often with the right structure to get into treatment. Sometimes, of course, that's a jail bed, clanging door treatment therapy. But with this one, I'm a little concerned about. I haven't been convinced that there's a whole lot of evidence that going from 1 to 3 years will result in lesser drunk driving. So I just want to give you a heads up that I'll be a no.
And I'll say one of the thoughts behind this bill that went into creating this bill was that a person would be encouraged not to blow a second time. The repeat offender would be encouraged not to blow, and they suffer no greater penalty than a first offender. And this is to make it
make it more costly if you're a repeat offender, you need to either take the breath test or plan on not driving for 3 years. Representative Krieger?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I looked at, we had some figures that talked about 10,000 and 2,000 went back and recommitted. So about 80% of the people, give or take, are not coming back for a second offense. It does concentrate our effort to repeat offenders. Irregardless of my background, Representative Olson's background, we're not exactly liberal towards things that take people's lives, and we've heard this here. Now, I think this is my fifth session, and I've never had a session that we didn't do something with DUII. I'd really like to have a work group put together that really addresses this much, much greater than what we have instead of this piecemeal. I'm probably going to vote for the bill, but I think be careful that we don't create something like going to 3 years from one, and pretty soon, now, you like it or not, are you going to cause employment in rural areas? Are you going to cause income loss? Are you going to cause more of those people to be on social programs? That's also something we need to weigh. But we do have to find a way to get them off the road.
And we need to remember, too, that we're not costing them. They're costing themselves. Yep. But Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some of the same concerns. I'll vote to move this out if you want to do that today. I'm not sure yet where I'll be on the floor. I'm concerned this is a bit of a blunt instrument, and it provides no discretion for individual circumstances. So I'm undecided.
Okay. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to, for some of us that maybe are new on the DUII stuff, that, in fact, the Chair and I have sat in on several of the Governor's Task Force committees, and there is a broader, you know, discussion with probably 30 people in the room talking about how this impacts a lot of different areas. And I know that this bill is a series. There's a series of bills that we're hearing here today, and I just want to make sure that there is a big discussion going on, and obviously we as individuals can't be in all those rooms, but I feel really proud about the work that's being done by that group on the several occasions that I've been there. And I also want to say on this particular bill, this is an example of a bill that does not have a fiscal to it, that does not cost the taxpayers money directly, that potentially could maybe get the attention of some people and change some behavior in our state.
Thank you. Further questions, comments? Representative Stigler.
Yeah, I was just going to emphasize, Your Honor, Mr. Chair, that this is a product of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI, and I'm aware that they have been working on some of these very issues for a lengthy period of time and trying to do it in a holistic manner so that we aren't, you know, just periodically coming up with. I think they're trying to take a big picture look at the whole area of drunk driving and potential.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
No.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
No.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnik.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Representative Olson, would you carry this for us, please? Thank you. Motion passes. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2339.
House Bill 2239 is essentially going to close the loophole currently. There are penalties if you refuse to give a breath test, but there are not the same penalty if you refuse to give your blood or urine test. This is particularly important in cases involving DREs, which are drug recognition experts, anytime someone might be under the influence of methamphetamine, marijuana, cocaine, any other number of substances. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. There's minimal fiscal impact and no revenue.
Okay, call first Mr. Hayes, Ann Pratt, and Amy Queen, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Chuck Hayes, the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. This is also a GAC bill, one that we have been working on for a number of years. Back in 2003, a bill was passed which created ORS 813095 to make it a make it an offense to refuse a breath test. This again is to encourage those people that are suspected of driving under the influence to give us a breath test so that obviously evidence is obtained. Also, we determine those high blood alcohol levels and those things. We're coming before you today to ask consideration under this bill to include also the refusal of blood and urine. The reason for that is because blood tests are obviously very instrumental in determining alcohol and or other drug impairment as well. And also with the advent of the Drug Recognition Expert Program here in the state of Oregon, where we DREs, drug recognition experts, are trained to evaluate people who are suspected of being under the influence of drugs other than alcohol, a urine test is now the test that is used for that to determine the presence of drugs in their system. So we are seeing that people now are starting to refuse those tests as well. In fact, in 2007, 2008, we had a total of 215 blood refusals, and then we also had urine refusals of 414. So again, these are people that are suspected of being under the influence and then asked to give a sample, and if they refuse, there is no penalty, an additional charge for the refusal to give one of those substances to the officer when they're suspected of being under the influence. So again, we just one of those things that we're trying to basically fix a loophole that was created in 2003 when we did pass the law to charge someone or the possibility of charging someone for refusing to give a breath test. So that's quick, but if you have any questions of me, I'd be happy to answer those whenever you're.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question. It seems to me in some ways urine and blood are different from breath. Breath sample doesn't remain on file. What happens to people who are acquitted? It seems to me we may have, there are issues, I think, of privacy involved here that I'm not sure are the same with breath samples. Do you agree with that? Was that considered?
Chair Barker and Representative Garrett, if I hopefully understand this correct, so if a person is acquitted and they have given a breath test or they have refused, is that a matter of privacy or public record? Is that,
well,
is that
point
your question?
If you give a blood sample, suddenly your DNA and other biological information is on file somewhere in a way that I don't think is true with a breath test. What happens then if a person ultimately is acquitted? We heard a bill last week dealing with taking a DNA sample for anybody arrested for a felony, and there were concerns expressed about that being a pretty significant expansion of DNA testing. So that's what's coming to my mind. Are we getting into privacy issues here that we should be sensitive to?
Chair Barker and Representative Garrett, I wish I had spent some time working for the Oregon State Police Crime Lab so I could answer that question for you, but I may have to defer that to maybe someone else, and if not, then we'll try to get you an answer on that, because if the blood sample is kept by the crime lab, I believe it's kept for a certain amount of time, and then it is destroyed. If not, we would have quite a bit of blood stored up. So if that case is acquitted, I believe that blood sample is destroyed, and so it is not on record.
Ms. Sybil, could you address that?
My understanding is that the blood sample is at the crime lab solely for the purposes of determining if there's a controlled substance in it. It can be tested at the lab or actually in the hospital itself. It is then not subject to being filed away in any kind of database. Okay. It is going to be kept for a certain period of time, but then it will be disposed of. And I can make phone calls and get you any more concrete information, but that's my understanding both from having practiced and talked to criminalists.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Again, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Amy Queen here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We are in support of House Bill 2239. As indicated numerous times now, this does kind of close a loophole, and as a practical matter, on a day-to-day basis in prosecuting and seeing an increase in not only DUIs that are from controlled substances, but combinations of alcohol and, for example, marijuana or methamphetamine. For example, someone blowing a .04, but obviously to a DRE person, something else is obviously more on board. Refusing the blood test or urine, they do not have the same penalties as if they just refused the breathalyzer. And so in closing that loophole, I think it just creates, I think, more of, I guess if you want to say equality across the board for offenders in that regard, and also helps with, ultimately, then the public safety, which is our concern.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Queen? Ms. Pratt.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Ann Pratt. I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. Some of you know me from past sessions. For those of you who don't, my son was killed by a drunk driver in 1998, and I've been coming to this building since 01, working on and fighting for tougher DUI laws. Before I begin my testimony, I'd like to get some figures out for you that you asked for earlier. It's the cost of one drunk driving fatality. That would be $1,210,000 for each fatality. And the total estimated economic cost of drunk driving related fatalities in Oregon is more than $181 million. And if you include the quality of life losses along with that, it's well over $6 million. House Bill 2239 is about responsibility, accountability, and public safety. The purpose of House Bill 2239 is very simple. It is to get at the truth by prompting DUI offenders to submit to blood or urine tests when asked to do so by law enforcement. It's about identifying the intoxicated drivers and getting them off our roads and reducing the threats by those hundreds of intoxicated drivers who use our roadways on a daily basis. Drivers who refuse blood, breath, or urine tests are very often considered high-risk DUI offenders, drivers, which are identified as those who have an alcohol or substance abuse problem and drive intoxicated on a regular basis. House Bill 2239 addresses some of these offenders as they slip through the cracks for refusal of blood and urine and often avoid being properly identified as repeat offenders. These high-risk offenders are a huge problem in our country and our state. They are already resistant enough to change. Let's not make it any easier for them to escape responsibility and accountability by allowing them the privilege of refusing a breath or urine test without a fine. If I were stopped and had been drinking, which, by the way, I wouldn't be, I can only think of one reason to refuse. I might be found legally intoxicated and guilty of driving under the influence of intoxicants if I complied, and possibly I'd been down this road before. We are told that repeat offenders are advised by their attorneys to refuse, and prosecutors do prosecute, but without that evidence is much more difficult. It takes more time, and time equates to dollars in the courtroom. We want offenders to comply with Oregon's implied consent law, and we would expect this fine to prompt more refusers to submit. It is the best evidence of guilt or innocence. A fact is, offenders who refuse the test tend to have higher recidivism rates and more previous offenses. I have included in my written testimony five cases with refusal history that have ended catastrophically with death or severe injury. Just the type of offender we are targeting with House Bill 2239. I'd like to point to the number one case, which Mr. Hayes also mentioned in his testimony, of Fivia Sharapoff, who drove south in the northbound lanes of I-5 just almost 2 years ago to the day and crashed head-on to a vehicle carrying three Eugene Symphony members. Two were killed nearly instantly, and one did survive with serious physical injury. She had a .246. This drunk driver had a prior DUI, and she also had a prior refusal. Again on that night, she refused, even after she knew she killed two people. As a mad victim advocate, that's another one of my hats, I'm also a member of MAD, I helped to support the families at the trial and the sentencing. Sheriff Huff stood at her sentencing, stated that she accepted no responsibility for what she had done. It was only about her. You may hear testimony claiming the rights of these intoxicated drivers would be violated by a fine for refusal of blood or urine. But what about the rights of every man, woman, and child to safe Oregon roadways, to be safe on the way to the grocery store, or a child to ride his bike to his grandmother's house, or a drive up the freeway? We need to identify these offenders to keep them off our roads. We need all the tools and resources possible. We also need to get them the necessary treatment. And I have certainly always supported treatment that's proven to work. A similar bill in, actually it was the 2005 session, House Bill 33, passed the House with 53 yes votes, but there wasn't enough time to get it through the Senate. Actually, last session, House Bill 2562 also passed the House with a 54-0 with a similar fate. Driving in Oregon is a privilege, not a right. Please pass House Bill 2239. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Chief Noble and Trooper Ewy, please. Senate to move. And again, just either one of you go in any order you'd like to, but just to remember to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Ron Noble. I'm currently the Chief of Police in McMinnville and representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. Just briefly, the Oregon Chiefs Association of Chiefs of Police support House Bill 2239. Since we've all bought off on the idea of implied consent and that somebody who drives a motor or operates a motor vehicle on our highways has given their consent for breath, blood, or urine, we do support the idea of equal treatment for a refusal of any one of those three, as this bill is proposing.
Chair, any questions, Chief, before we go on? Trooper, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Michael Ewy. I'm a senior trooper with the State Police Side of the Patrol Services Division, and I'm also the Drug Evaluation Classification Program Manager for the entire state. Now, with regards to House Bill 2239, obviously it's going to amend ORS 813-095 to also include blood and urine, and this is going to be under the motor supply consent law. So this is not going to be on a consent issue, but only applying when the motor supply consent law is going to be read to the petitioner under the suspect. Last year, we had, for 2007, we had 16,836 breath test failures, 3,620 breath refusals, 201 urine refusals, and 117 blood refusals. For 2008, there were 15,849 breath test failures, 3,489 breath refusals, 148 urine refusals, and 98 blood refusals. This is going to be very imperative because when a person refuses the breath, blood and the urine under implied consent, all that we can do is impose a potential license sanction through implied consent, DMV. However, we cannot issue them an additional citation. 813-095 would provide that. We can issue a citation for refusing to provide breath and urine. And I want to be clear that in Oregon, the urine is actually tested for drugs. So we use a suspect's urine to test for drugs. For ETOH or blood alcohol content, we use blood. We can send the blood to Legacy Emanuel and they can test the blood for drugs. However, then we run into problems that they are not a crime lab. They're a hospital. So we try to use the crime labs. I'm trying to get into this because we're now going to start talking about the Oregon Drug Recognition Expert Program. Currently, we have 196 drug recognition experts. I have 36 drug recognition expert instructors. And we have a very huge problem, of course, with impaired driving having to do with drugs other than alcohol. In 2007, we performed 1,247 drug evaluations where 51 refused to provide urine, which failed to corroborate the evaluator's opinion. So through our drug evaluation, although a DRE may have said this person is under the influence of cannabis or a CNS stimulant such as methamphetamine, we were not able to corroborate that to facilitate that for conviction through the DA's office because we didn't have the additional evidence. We did not get the urine. Similarly speaking, for 2008, we performed 986 drug evaluations where 27 refused to provide urine. Again, it makes it much more difficult for the DA's office to actually prosecute the DUIs when we don't have that evidence to support the case. These numbers for 2008 are lower because not all the data entry has been compiled yet for 2008. Chair Barker and members of the committee, that concludes my written testimony, or verbal testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be more happy to answer those.
Thank you, Trooper. In the last sessions when we passed this, the question has always come up. Some people are under the impression that if you allowed this, that the police officer would be drawing the blood.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, that is not correct.
Okay.
We will use an ER technician or a phlebotomist. We'll take the blood. We'll just observe it.
Mr. Chair. Representative Cameron?
No, knowing how stiff Representative Olson is, when I hug him, I'm not sure I want him poking needles at me.
I don't know if you really wanted that read in the record.
Or that one, maybe.
We just brought up a good thought, though. I mean,
Any further questions? Thank you. Ms. Meyer, Mr. Duvall, Mr. Duvall.
I hope he doesn't take that wrong.
How could you?
Either one, you just go ahead and just identify yourself, please.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I've asked an experienced DWI practitioner to join me today, and that would be Hugh Duvall, and he's by my side.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Hugh Duvall. I understand the desire to make or to make this law consistent wherever somebody may be refusing to provide a sample. Understanding that the backdrop is that there is also already a penalty for refusing to provide it, and that's, of course, the driver's license impact upon the person, which is always significantly greater if the person refuses than if they provide it, and it appears maybe even more significantly greater if they refuse, if the blackout periods are extended. The distinction that I would like to ask the committee to consider is one between urine and blood. Urine, as previous testimony has been, comes up where the question of controlled substances on board is an issue, and a request for a urine sample is made. My experience is that that's usually conducted at the jail or the station or wherever the person is, where they have taken an intoxilizer test, and there's a question about the controlled substances. Blood, on the other hand, is something that we find in a circumstance where the subject, the defendant, is oftentimes in a hospital or a medical setting. They are receiving treatment. From my standpoint and my discussing this matter with people who have refused a blood test, they're not in a very good circumstance to make an intelligent choice. They're in a worse circumstance than someone who's at the station who's blown in the machine or said they won't provide a urine sample. They've been in an accident, oftentimes a very serious one. They might have a hand or head injury. They might have, of course, they have some other kind of medical problem that's happening, and that plays a role in their ability to make the decision: do I want to provide the blood sample? Do I not? They're not on equal footing with the defendant who's sitting at the station, and I'd ask that be recognized. The other thing is this, and it's just my personal perspective, I don't have any statistics. I'm trying to remember the last time that I had a case where my client was in a hospital and they were asked to provide a blood sample, and the hospital had not already taken a blood sample for medical purposes, and frankly, in most cases already shared that with the officer who was investigating the case. So I draw a distinction on the blood draws. I can't provide the committee with a percentage, but again, I can't remember the last time that the blood evidence was not already available as a matter of medical testing that was available to the government to seize and take. And of course, the law enforcement officer is always free to seek a search warrant to obtain the blood sample in that kind of a circumstance. Even of course, Oregon has a provision that lets them get a telephonic search warrant in that kind of a circumstance. I handled a case in Polk County not too long ago where even on a refusal to blow in the machine, a search warrant was obtained in a DUI case. It wasn't in an accident. Then they got a search warrant, and they got blood from the defendant. So that's all that I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So you got blood from a defendant who refused a breath test? Or
in Polk County, yes, I had one like that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Stigler?
Just your example about blood taken during the course of the procedures at a hospital, the police wouldn't be able to utilize that for purposes, i.e. other than, I mean, they couldn't utilize it for determining blood alcohol level unless they got that search warrant. Isn't that correct? If it's not drawn for that purpose under a search, I mean, if it's drawn for medical purposes, they'd need to get the warrant to be able to utilize it.
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, my understanding of the law and recent case law is that a blood alcohol result from a medical blood draw is admissible in a criminal case. I don't know if you're referring to the implied consent law or the criminal case itself.
Well, there wouldn't be implied consent if the blood wasn't taken for that purpose.
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, that's my understanding, yes.
The policing, Ms. Semple, would you explain that at all?
I'll be frank, it's been a while since I've tried a DUI trial, but I believe the difference perhaps that you're getting at is that, if I'm not mistaken, the hospital can, of their own volition,
right,
can test the blood.
But an
officer can't walk up to them and say, I need the blood for this, go test it and have them do it. I believe I'm correct with that. It's going to be at the direction of an officer for the purposes of a DUI investigation, it's, at least in my experience, typically done through a warrant. But.
Representative Cameron, didn't you have a problem in one of your hospitals with something over that last?
You're here in Salem.
And what was that problem? I just recall there was, so I don't remember what it was.
It was a problem of getting the hospital to cooperate with Albany. I think it happened in Albany, too. Getting the problem was getting the hospital to cooperate with getting the blood sample drawn.
Different issue because, obviously that's not the person's. Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be a question to the chair or to Shannon, or it might be a question to you. What, if any, interface is there with this bill and the previous? And if that's a stupid question, I apologize. But is any of the stuff that we just moved out of committee in the last House bill interface with this stuff? To what degree?
I'm just going to repeat it back to you, if that's okay.
Yeah.
The last bill basically allows for there to be an increased penalty in the time that lapses from the hardship permit.
Yeah.
This now, there's a fine component to failure or to a refusal.
Yep.
And currently there's a fine if you refuse to blow, but there's not a fine if you refuse the urine or the blood.
Yep.
So this addresses, yes, very similar. It's just kind of the next stepping stone down the path, if that makes sense.
It's a slightly different question, but I think I got it. Thank you.
You could be fined if you refuse a breath test, but not if you refuse the blood or the urine.
Yeah, that part of it.
We passed this law twice in the House, and it has not...
Right.
It's died in the Senate either for lack of time or somebody opposed it over there. So, any further discussion? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I'd like to acknowledge written testimony from Mothers Against Drunk Driving and Benita Howard on this bill as well. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2239. Okay, and open a work session on House Bill 2239. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Stiegler.
I just wanted to point out to Representative Garrett that blood and urine can be taken and drawn or given as part of the implied consent currently under existing law. So the issues that you're concerned about, they're not going to be exacerbated by this particular provision. I mean, blood and urine is already taken. There's procedures established as to how those are dealt with and handled and how the records are kept and that kind of thing.
So DNA.
This doesn't fall. I mean, it's not like this is in addition to. It's something that's already done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I notice this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but it seems to me that this one would almost have less of an impact fiscally than 2238, which I would think would result in, you know, more people getting arrested for, you know, driving without a license. So I just wanted to mention to you 2239. I'd be happy to also talk to the Speaker's office with you about rescinding that subsequent referral.
Actually, my next request is going to be that I'm not sure if you vote before or after that, but that would be helpful because I'm pretty sure they will contact me to send it back.
Okay. Further questions? So we do have a subsequent. So we need
no carriers.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and accept a motion to Senate House Bill 23 to pass 2239. A little dyslexic here, with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
So moved.
Representative Shields moves House Bill 2239 with due pass with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Further discussion. Hearing none. Roll call. Please.
Roll call.
Okay.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. I'm going to briefly reopen the reconsideration on House Bill 2170 and allow Representative Garrett a chance to vote on that. On the re.
Aye.
Okay. Thank you. Close the session.
Okay. We're going to open a work session on 2052. This needs to be referred to the House Committee on Human Services.
Open a work session on House Bill 2052, and I accept a motion. Right? Okay. I would accept a motion to refer House Bill 2052 to the Human Services with no recommendation.
I so move, Your Mr. Chair.
Representative Stiegler so moves. Is there any discussion? Hearing that, Representative Cameron.
Didn't we just pass that to the floor of the due pass recommendation of the first thing we did?
No.
Different bill.
That was House Bill 2170.
2170. Okay.
Yeah,
thank you.
2052.
I got it.
Okay. Roll call, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye.
Motion carries. Okay. Further business before the committee today.
How are you feeling?
Seeing none. Meeting adjourned.
For a minute.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the deal.